Welcome to the Foster Care Town Hall hosted by Tidewater Friends of Foster Care. We have an incredible panel today and are going to be having a conversation about the state of foster care, specifically in Virginia. Before we get started, I'm going to take a minute and the panel is going to introduce themselves to you. So Audra, will you please kick us off?
Absolutely. Thanks, Aaron. I'm Audra Bullock. I'm president and founder of Tidewater Friends of Foster Care. I am a foster and adoptive parent.
Awesome. John?
Hi, I'm John Murray. I'm CEO and president of Families First, so therapeutic foster care agency here in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and Tidewater.
Perfect. Lakaisha?
Hi, I am Lakaisha Lang, and I am a foster care alumna who was eventually adopted into a loving family. I currently work for Cox Communications as the director of their onboarding processes and teams. And I'm also the president of the National Association for Multi-Ethnicity in Communications, Virginia chapter. Happy to be here.
Amazing. Lakora.
Hello, I'm Lakora Harris. I bring you greetings from the professional world of social services. I've hailed from Norfolk Department of Social Services, and now I work in Spotsylvania County in Spotsylvania, Virginia at social services there. And I am a services divisions director. So I oversee CPS, foster care, as well as APS services. So hello, everybody.
Beautiful. And Tom.
Hi, I'm Tom Powell. My wife, Wendy, and I are foster parents here in Suffolk, Virginia.
Beautiful. And I'm Erin Lindstrom. I am the co-host of Foster Care Aware, a Tidewater Friends of Foster Care supporter and a future foster parent. I've been through the training and we will get there slowly but surely. So I am super excited for today's discussion. Thank you so much for joining us. This conversation that we're about to have is something foster care has been going on for years, and there are many children that come in and out of the system each year in the United States and really across the world. And it's not something that we talk about regularly. So this conversation is really important, and it's really important that you're here. So thank you for being a part of it. And please, wherever you kind of go from this conversation, I just invite you to take a nugget from this and share it with someone else, because part of the work here is really to bring awareness. So to start off today's discussion, Audra is going to share with us a bit about what's actually going on right now in foster care. We're going to talk through a lot of data. Don't worry about getting lost in any of it or holding on to any of the numbers. After we take sort of a high level look at the situation, we're then going to move into a conversation about what all of this means. So with that, Audra, if you want to kick us off.
Super. Thanks, Erin. Appreciate the introduction. So like you said, Erin, there are lots of children that are involved in the foster care system. In the United States, over 600,000 kids are involved in the foster care system each year, and about 7,000 of those come from the state of Virginia. Now, what we want to do is bring light to these children, that they're more than numbers, and have our community engage in helping to make a difference to the outcomes of these kids. I feel like I need to explain foster care in a brief summary so that we're all on the same page. It's a dynamic process where the state's taken responsibility for caring for a child when they've deemed that their family is no longer able to do that safely, while they implement services so that the family can rectify whatever the dangerous circumstances that precipitated the child coming into care. The state relies on families and organizations to take care of these children. There are no more state-run orphanages. There are volunteer families that come forward to care for children. There are group homes, there are residential facilities, but nonetheless, the state gets people involved in the lives of these children. Now, it's an ongoing custody case, meaning that the state has temporary custody, looking to give custody back to their parents. But this is an evolving case. It has a timeline to it. And so the system as a whole and the population as a whole is dynamic, meaning that the numbers change from day to day. Some children are entering care, other children are leaving care. So at any given time, if we snapshot across the US, there are over 420,000 in care. There are many, many more that interact with the system each year. And so I stress the importance of those larger numbers, because that's really the impact. Those are the kids that are impacted by foster care each year. So let's dive a little bit deeper into Virginia's foster care numbers. So like I said, this is a snapshot in time. And I'll talk about some of the trends that have happened. But right as of March 1st, 2021, that was the most recent data from the Virginia Department of Social Services, there were 5,240 children in Virginia foster care. By gender, we have 52% boys, 48% girls. By race, we have 28% Black children, 60% white children, 9% multiracial children, and 4% other. We have about 11% Hispanic ethnicity. Age range of children in foster care. We can have anyone from newborns all the way up in the state of Virginia to their 21st birthday. And if we break that out by age, we have just over 4% are under 1 year old. We have about 24% that are between the ages 1 and 5, 14.5% between 6 and 9, 15% of those children are between 13 to 15, 21% right now are between 16 and 18, and just under 11% are 19 or older in foster care. So if you're to look at that distribution, it looks bimodal. There's a big group in the young under 5 age, and then there's another big group in the 16 to 18 year old age. And the two populations spend different amounts of time in foster care, but if we look at the overall time, the average time for all children spent in foster care, it's about 20.5 months for the state of Virginia. From region to region, that will change. For example, in Hampton Roads, we're at 28 months. That's 863 days in care. That's a long time in care. But that's principally driven by a large population of teens. The 24.5 months represents over 600 days in care. And that is spent in this evolving custody case. And that case has evolving goals. But as of March 1st, the population had the following goals. 31.8% were return home. That's returned to their parents. 8.1% had returned to relative placement. So that's not their parents, but it's a relative in their family or fictive kin, the auntie, uncle that lived next door that you've grown up with. 35% have a goal of adoption. 13.9% have a goal of independent living. These are children over the age of 14 who the state is trying to facilitate them living on their own as adults. And that's, again, teenagers still, but living on their own. And then 3.6% have a goal of permanent foster care. Well, they will not be finding their permanency in a family setting. That can be quite sad. So that's the current snapshot of foster care in Virginia.
Okay, thank you. So those numbers, I think sometimes we get lost almost in the numbers. As you're talking and we're listening, it's very easy to hear statistics and forget that we're talking about humans with hearts and people and children and all of these things. So I'm very excited to kind of break this down inside the conversation and hear from all different perspectives, from the agency side, from human services, from actually being in the system, to being a foster parent, to being an organization that really wraps around the children and families who are related to the system. So to kind of start us off, you mentioned that 40% of foster children have a care goal of returning to their family of origin.
That's right. Now, 32% going to their parents and 8% going to relatives.
Got it. Okay. So Tom, I'm wondering, can you tell us a little bit, like when it comes to, I mean, I feel like the first thing that always comes up when people think about fostering is, oh my gosh, my heart is going to break. Like, I don't know if I could do that. And I would love to hear a little bit about your perspective about how foster parents can show up and really support this goal of reunification.
Right. Well, the reality is that is a true statement, and there's no sugarcoating that. Your heart will break. Those kids will leave if you invest in their lives. That's the reality. But the trade-off is so much greater than our little heartbreak for a short time. And the trade-off being these small children getting back to a situation where they can now thrive and be loved on by family members.
Yeah, I think it's so important. Audra, do you have anything that you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, I concur wholeheartedly with what Tom said. You get over the heartbreak, but I think that if you're, you know, if you're doing it the right way, you should be heartbroken. That's the investment in these kids, right? That's what they absolutely need. Lakora was one of the workers who trained me as a foster parent, and she has a thing that she says, you gotta love them like they're yours and be ready to let them go. And it's that heart work that I think really makes a difference for a child while they're in foster care, because foster care is born out of trauma, right? There's traumatic incidences that happen in the family of origin, the trauma of leaving that family and coming into care. And it really takes a one-on-one human, you know, heartfelt connection to help these children heal.
Mm-hmm. So while the goal of foster care is reunification, in cases where that's not possible, we do look at other options. So in 35% of the cases in Virginia, foster children have the case goal of adoption. Lakaisha, I know you were a child and you were a child, surprise, but in the foster care system and then were adopted. I'm wondering, would you be open to telling us a bit about your experience?
Sure. So my experience with foster care and adoption came on the heels of a tragedy. I was 3 years old and my twin sister was killed at the hands of a stranger that my mom, who was battling drug addiction, left us with for the day. She drowned and killed my twin sister in front of my brother. And from there, we were placed into foster care. We stayed in foster care from the age of 3 through 13 for myself. By the time we were adopted, there were, you know, over to Audra's point, 500,000 children in foster care. I'd also like to point out that back then, we were fortunate that our parents were married, because back in the 70s, when adoption was around, you had to be married. Single parents were not considered eligible to adopt back then, nor were there options for our LGBTQ+ communities, where at that point, you had to be a straight married couple. And so if you think about the progress we've made over the years, I feel very fortunate to have been able to be with a family who took us in at a tragic time. But I'll tell you that growing up in foster care wasn't easy. We didn't often fit in, because once people found out we were from foster care, there was a stigma attached to us. We got teased. We had clothing that may have been a size too large, because we were told to grow into it, because we didn't have resources to buy clothing that was of size at that time. I was bullied. I had a lazy eye as a child and I had to wear a patch. And so if you can imagine already someone knowing that you're different, but then also going to school with a patch over your eye, the kids were brutal. But what I took from that, you know, even being on welfare, using food stamps and getting by day to day to ensure that the family had what they needed, my parents did the best they could. What I also love about them is that in addition to myself and my brother, they had already adopted 3 other boys. So we were an adopted family of 5, but they also had their own biological children and they had 4 of their own children. So we were, 5 and 4 is 9, and them, it's what, 11, right? So we were a family of 11. And so they took the time to really invest in us. I'm forever grateful for the love and care given to my brother and myself by the Grant family. So, you know, may they rest in peace, James and Naomi Grant, for all that they have done, not just for us, but the foster care community. I'm the woman I am today because of them. And, you know, I'll just share, my dad would always tell me, treat others the way you want to be treated. Save money, not just for a rainy day, but for a storm. and then give back, if not monetarily through your time. And I hope that I'm able to show that. And I hope that the work that I continue to do with the Tidewater Friends of Foster Care shows that as well.
Thank you so much for sharing so openly and vulnerably with us. Really appreciate it. Wow. LaCora, from the perspective of the Department of Human Services, for people who are considering becoming foster and or adoptive parents, like what do they need to know? What should they be thinking about that might not automatically be something that comes up when you Google become a foster parent?
Oh man. Well, first of all, I just want to say everybody's points already have been so like on point. Like, I don't know that you guys even need anything from me. Your Audra and Tom, you guys are so like well-versed, you got it. And Lakaisha, clearly your parents had it down to a science. So I'm just, my heart is full to hear you guys speak. I think what parents need to know, or I hope they know or learn from somebody, is one, you need a support system for sure. This is, I don't even think when you have kids of your own, it's something you can do by yourself. So certainly when you are fostering and adopting children, you need people. It's a village. It still takes a village. That's still true. It's not just because some service has approved you and said you've got the financial capability and, you know, you're capable. So you got it all by yourself. It's not that. It really takes a village to do this. So know who your supports are, create supports, seek support, so that you can, you know, really give back to those children and give time to yourself when you need it, because you will need it.
Because you will need it. I like the wording and the honesty there too.
You will, yes, I believe in the honesty. There's no need not to be transparent.
Yeah.
You know, and I would say that, like, be aware, be very self-aware and not afraid. Audra talked about our relationship. I love that she didn't mind saying, hey, you know, whatever, because we could have very honest conversations. And for me, it helped me move in directions to assist where I could, or to say, I'm scratching my head. Let's see if I can come up, you know, let me check some things out. I loved when she found stuff and told me, and I shared it with other people. So, you know, be aware and be okay with the transparency and the vulnerability that comes with, you know, with fostering and adopting.
Yeah, I love that you're talking about that, and particularly the level of like honesty, right? And using your support system. And I feel like, John, in our conversations, that's something you've talked about, of like really using your caseworker and using the people that are around you to share what's happening, so you can get the support you need. You don't have to have all of the answers to be a parent. So when we talk about the length of time that children are typically averaging in foster care right now, we're looking at 600 plus days, which is a very long time for a child to be without the family that they were growing up with, right? So John, I'm wondering, can you speak a bit about the impact that has on a child and how foster parents can help potentially minimize the negative impact there?
Absolutely. I think when you look at impact, that is that how it's affecting children and how it's affecting family at the same time, that as foster parents or adoptive parents, depending on what type of adoption you're going through, you know, the connection with the family is always there. Despite what we want to say about the circumstances of what led to children coming into care, those children are wired for that family. And that desire for them to be a part of that doesn't go away. And so I think families that embrace that and can look at that from the perspective of broadening your family, not just with the child, but the family. That I think a lot of foster parents are out to help children, save children, help children get better. But be open to the whole process. Be open to the process of how children are going to enrich your life, how they're going to make you better, how they're going to make you a better parent. I think there's multiple ways of looking at impact. And I think the importance of what we're doing is we got to look at it holistically. We can't just treat the child. We have to treat the family. And it's easy to want to save children and work with children, but it's more challenging to work with families. And I think that the foster care system, as we're looking at how it should grow and how our focus should be altered at different times, is if it truly has a family focus, even if the goal is not to return home, if we still have a family focus, how we're strengthening family relationships is really the key to creating environments where children can heal. Because here's a simple fact when it comes to science, and I'm always going to talk to you about science. children don't heal unless they're with a family. That's a fact. Whether that's a biological family, whether that's a foster family, whether it's adoptive parent, whether it's with a respite parent, a temporary family, it's that's the only environment where how brains are designed, where we can actually go back in time and heal that trauma history. And the importance of that is you're going to have to rely on the team to help create that environment. And that team has to support you. And I think the team has to understand, when I'm looking at two false parents, I'm trying to look on the screen and stare at you, no offense, that despite what the professionals know, and I've been doing this 30 years, despite what I know, there's a lot I don't know because I'm not a foster parent. And I think the professionals have to be open to what foster parents can teach the professionals about impact. Because when you take a child into your home that has that trauma history, guess what happens to you? You start living that trauma history yourself. And that could be healing for you, and that could be healing for the child if you're open up to the full process, if you're willing to invite the team to work with you and grow as a parent.
Yeah, John, I'm gonna jump in here and say that's absolutely right. This is the 24/7 of it, and foster parents know these kids, I think, better than anyone, and do live through their trauma. And sometimes we're very raw about, you know, the way that the children are moved through the system, and, you know, kind of dealing with the trauma that the system imposes on these kids, and wishing that we could change. I mean, Tom, I know you have some opinions here. You're a foster parent. You've lived this. Tell us.
I do. I'm actually going to go on the other side of that impact for my own family. So we foster newborns to 2 years old. So we're all that they know. I mean, we've picked up babies 2 days old, 9 days old from the hospital, and our family has immediately fallen in love with them to the point where people look at me, and I'm sure any others, and say, you know, you guys are doing so good for these kids. And my first response is, well, no, they're doing a lot for us. I mean, I have four of my own children, which is quite a broodful. They're 16, 18, 20, and 22. They all live at home still. You know, they're studying to do whatever they want to do, but they have been intimately impacted to the point where I've seen my 12-year-old son change a diaper. I never did that when I was 12. To the point where, you know, my third son is now, you know, he's writing essays and he's trying to get to school. He wants to be a pediatrician. And I read some of his essays, and the reason he wants to do that is the direct impact of what foster care has done in our house. He wants every child to have a chance to thrive, no matter where they come from. So
that's beautiful. John, you made a point that I want to swing back to. You said that, according to science, right? Like, children have to be in a family dynamic to actually have the chance to heal, right? Did I catch that correctly? Can you tell me, like, obviously families come in all shapes, sizes, ways. Like, what is that actual connection that we're looking for to define, like, family here?
The connection will be influence. The connection is a family able to provide enough time? And Tom's talking about babies. Like, we're forced with babies to spend a large amount of time with babies. But let's go back and think about the other side of that spectrum for a 16-year-old child. What's the amount of time and influence that a family can provide? Like, if they can prove, and this is not verbally, by the way, this is usually by action. If they can prove that a child can be loved and cared for without abuse, and there's two different ways to express that. There's two different ways to look at love through a family setting. It is that unconditional love of, I love you for who you are, not what you do. I just love you for you. And then the second style of expression of love is loving you for the future, what you could be. And when families are able to express both those types of expression of love, it creates that environment where children can attach. Because right now, think about this. If you were abused, the most scary place, the most terrifying place a child could be is in a home setting, because that's where they were abused. And where do we put them? We put them in another home setting. So we're triggering them, but at the same time, that's the only place they're going to really heal. Earlier, we talked about orphanages, like they don't exist anymore. I'm old enough where I actually volunteered at an orphanage, believe it or not, when I was young. And you look at organizations, they cannot provide what a family can provide. They just cannot stimulate the part of the brain that actually has to be healed enough. And that time factor is the biggest issue in foster care and adoption. It's the amount of time that a family can spend in a calm, regulated, connected manner, and children will heal.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that. So when we look at the current population in foster care, we have two of the largest age groups are between 1 and 5. And then there's another large population from 16 to 18 year olds. Audra, can you speak a little bit about how the system works to meet the diverse needs of these children?
Sure, Erin. And they are diverse, but they're also somewhat the same, like what John was saying. Mm-hmm. And our psychiatrist has said to us, our family psychiatrist, nothing happens outside of an attachment for healing a child. So you have to make that connection. But yes, we have to train our parents differently, right, for dealing with a 1 to 5 year old baby. And there is training that needs to happen. It's not just you're going to have an infant and it's a clean slate kind of approach. You can have an infant, and this has happened in our family, at 6 months old that has severe trauma, developmental trauma at an age that it really does kind of get to the core of their being and lasts for a very long time. And so you have to be prepared. It's not just your everyday parenting of your biological children. And then on the spectrum of the teens, you've got these kind of autonomous teenagers, they can function a lot for themselves, but they have deep-seated needs. And you have to approach the attachment and getting to know them and getting to understand them and being there for them in ways that meet them at their developmental age, not necessarily their chronological age. And for most kids in foster care, those are two different things. And it's a mind shift in your approach, but it's about the training. It's about really taking the training seriously and doing the ongoing training and the exploration, because there's a requirement for, maybe it's 10 hours per year, but that's really not enough. We all just need to sit down with John once a week and learn how to be great foster parents, because there are challenges, and you can go through the pride classes or whatever the introductory courses are for the particular agency, and walking it in the moment is different than, being textbook smart.
Yeah. It reminds me a lot of like the personal development journey, and like, as life continues, there's more development. And it's the same thing I imagine when you're walking through life with a child as well.
Hey, Erin, can I add to
that? Of course. Yes, please.
So what John said, and even what Audra said, came around full circle for me. So, we were in foster care for 10 years. And through that period of time, I was experiencing all of that bullying and not feeling part of a group or a school and all of that stuff. So by the time I turned 13, my mom had done the work. She had participated in the classes. She had taken us to the psychiatrist to get the help that we needed. She took us on excursions to further our education and go to museums and things like that. Not always with the financial need to do so, but they found a way to do it. By the time she passed away when I was 19, I had everything that I needed from that influence perspective to then go on and be the woman I am today, and then have my father take me through the rest of my years. So it's so important that you do the work, because the work is not only going to make you a stronger person, a more compassionate person, but you're also providing those life skills along the way that will ultimately set the child to future adult up for success as they go on their own.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for adding that perspective too. So going back to the numbers for a minute, right? One of the things that we looked at is that 75% of children in care receive family placements, while 25 do not. LaCora, can you kind of just speak to and explain to our listeners a little bit about why a foster child may not receive a family placement? Like, what are the other options? Why might that happen?
That is really dependent upon the agency's ability to identify family. So it really has everything and what the family circumstances are. So if you are in a situation where family members have systemic abuse issues going on, whether that be substance abuse, you know, and it's been a life cycle of this amongst them, you may find that in our agency, we're not able to place because other relatives have what we call history with the department, which can make it difficult for us to find placements for children that are relative. But also the good thing is where we are now, they are taking the fictive kin title away and calling it kinship, so that it is no longer a difference between the relative that's blood and the relative that is your relative, because they're the ones that your mom places you with when she can't take care of you, or your caretaker, because it is not necessarily that a child is with their biological parents. They may be with a grandma, or, you know, when they come into care. So whoever that caretaker is identified, not able to meet that young person's needs. If there is a relative, a neighbor that has that ability, they're no longer seen as fictive, but as kinship placement. So I think that those numbers are a little skewed, but I think they'll, you know, continue to look a little different as we call it different now at this point.
Gotcha. And that's a great point too, that like everything is constantly shifting, yes, as definitions shift as well. What is kind of, can you paint a picture around like, what is a situation where a child would end up like an independent living and kind of like aging out of the system or in a group home or something like that?
Okay. So you, Audra mentioned earlier about the independent living goal and the permanent foster care goal. You cannot have the independent living goal until you're 18. In our system OASIS, when we click, we can't click independent living until that person is 18. And I brought that up because I think it's important for people to know that that means there's some child at 14, 15 years old who might be sitting on the goal of permanent foster care, or even the goal of adoption, and have no identified permanent placement. For me, that's probably one of the scariest things that I think I find. John spoke a lot about that, you know, that family. And so if you have kids of that age, even younger, who do not feel like they have a family environment, but yet because state-wise, we have in guidelines that say we need, you know, we need to do permanency by 24 months for this kid, 12 to 15 months, we should be working at relative foster return home relative placement goal. By 24 months, we should have achieved the goal of adoption if that hasn't worked. Now, all of us on this line know that that doesn't necessarily happen that way. But when we think about youth whose goal changes to adoption or permanent foster care, and we don't have an identified placement, and they don't know, have that family feel like John talked about, I think there are a lot of times when those kids become what we call our lifers. And so, yes, that rebellion of this system that cannot give me a family, but tells me what to do and where I have to go and sends me from person to person. And sometimes they're not so good at asking me what I need. Right. You know, that I think that kind of has a lot to do with the group home settings. Some of it is just age. The unfortunate nature is that there aren't a lot of people who are getting into fostering because they're like, I want a cool 14-year-old who might cuss me out. That sounds like what I want to do today. So, you know, with that being said, a baby's cute and cuddly, but this 14-year-old's behaviors, and I say that intentionally, their behaviors say something, but it is not who they are. You know, that right. is a symptom of something else, right?
Right.
And so I try to really tell people that baby, you just can't see what they may come with. There is something so different about you think you're getting a baby that's cute, cuddly, wrapped up in a bow. And in 2 years, all of a sudden, I'm going to say it, all hell breaks loose. And you're like, where was that worker I worked with? Because they didn't tell me this kid was going to act like this. And I had no idea they were going to act like that, right? So I think those things, because kids are older and people make assumptions about who that person is or going to be, or the establishment of who they know, like John talked about, their family, that understanding where they came from and wanting to hold tight to who their history, and people having a hard time being unafraid of unpacking that for them, what that means to me as the foster parent who wants you to accept me. But if you don't let go of home, then how do I get you to accept me? So that fear of unpacking that and the fear of having that, allowing that young person to unpack that, whatever comes along with it, and our need state-wise to meet certain guidelines are the things to me that drive that, that age range of that independent living and permanent foster care. And again, the ones that are, have that goal of adoption that don't have adoptive placements, because there are those too. You know, everybody thinks because somebody has a goal of adoption, oh, they're getting adopted tomorrow. That's not always true. So
Right. There's time is a big player, I imagine.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. So one of the things you touched upon is children moving homes while they're in care. And what we know is that right now, 25% of foster children in Virginia actually move four or more homes while they're in care. John, I'm wondering, can you share with us a little bit about what impact does that have on a child and how can we begin to minimize that?
Look at impact on multiple moves. Each time you have a child move from home to home, you are having to regress back to whatever progress they've made in attachment. And that's the biggest factor I want to talk about is that they start that attachment process, then they are moved to another home, they've got to start over again. Each time they move, it's less likely they're going to form a healthy attachment. Each move. Each time they move, they're about on average about a year behind academically. There's multiple ways that they're losing out by the moves. I think that what leads to multiple moves for most foster children is fear. I just did a training with my foster parents last night. What's the number one reason why children move home to home? Disrespectful behavior, not violent behavior, not fire setting, not all these extreme behaviors, but that disrespect. Why is that so challenging? If the parent doesn't feel connected with the child, it is very unlikely the child's going to connect with the parent. And if you're not working on understanding your focus, this is about target. Like if you don't have the target that you're supposed to be focused on as a foster parent or adoptive parent, you're going to see the child not be able to attach. And there should be specific techniques and specific understanding of what you're seeing. Because sometimes in foster care, what you see is not true. Like he doesn't care or he doesn't want to be a part of a family. That's not the truth. The truth is in that moment, he cannot connect or she cannot connect. And if you really work with a family understanding that process, I find it's less likely they're going to move. Now, sometimes that's just going to happen because if it's a, maybe it's a matching issue or a violent issue or some extreme behaviors. But really, if you're working extremely hard with the family, you can reduce those multiple moves if they have the proper support, education, and if they have a target that they know how to reach.
Beautiful.
Can I add to that? I just was going to say, John, that is so on point. And I wanted to share this story that one time I had a foster parent who said to me, I had an eight-year-old. I mean, eight-year-old that was like a handful. And she said, he doesn't respect me. He's not showing me respect. And in my, you know, not John language, because, you know, Mr. Murray, you have it down to the science, pun intended. I said to her, I said, what is respect? If language, curse words were a part of where this child came from, how do you know that their intention is to disrespect you? Mm-hmm. And I said, let's talk about the fact that you can't teach a child, you can't say a child should know addition if they don't know what 1 + 1 is. So did we ever start with establishing what respect is in your home? Like if stomping down the hall is disrespectful, but they stomp their whole life, are they disrespecting you? Or is that just the way they've learned that they show they're mad? And that's what everybody did. Let's talk about what that looks like. So, you know, you have that opportunity to bring that to the table. Thank you, John. I appreciate your work. I've got to sit in some of your trainings. But, you know, you bring that level of back to the basics for people to the table that lets them know, again, I need to, it's like any other relationship. You have to tell people what you want. And if you can't tell even these kids, hey, when you say this, that hurts my feelings. If you've got a level to you that is too afraid to do that because you're afraid that they might challenge that, then we already have a problem because you're going to harbor a lot of stuff that they start doing because you're already saying they can pit, they're pushing my buttons. Make sure they even know what your buttons are.
Well, and LaCora, you make an interesting point. And I think it's interesting, the fact that we all have buttons, right? Like that can be pushed. And I think a huge part of the work of being a foster parent is being aware of the fact that, oh my God, I have buttons and you have buttons and we all have buttons. And like, really becoming aware of like how we each work and how we get triggered so that you can actually let go of some of the behavior or the things that are happening
exactly.
that are causing you to feel a certain way and instead look at what's behind the behavior and how can we reconnect.
Knowing that. That's your power, is knowing you have buttons and you know where they are, you know your triggers. And again, that's your power because it's also your teaching tool. Because some of these kids, like they don't know what their triggers are. They don't know that that's a trigger.
Right. I think most humans don't actually even know. So
exactly.
We are going to, I would love to talk for a minute about the impacts of COVID on the foster care world. Audra, I'm sure you have some data. Would you like to share with us?
You have data. You know me well. Yeah. So one of the things that I gave the snapshot, right? But I didn't give you any relative, perspective on that. So year over year, right? From the beginning of COVID, we've had about a 7% decline in the overall population of kids in foster care. That's, the 5,600 down to 5,200 in care. But our population really has shifted. And I think this is what motivates me to get out and kind of beat the drum of everybody get on board and let's start getting our foster care training and our support systems and our support families in order. Because when the vaccines completely roll out and the world opens up, we're going to see some floodgates. And here's why. The 19 and over population since COVID hit has increased dramatically, like 20 some percent. Let me give you the exact number. It's up 17%. Okay. That's kids that are like what LaCora was saying about the independent living. These are kids mostly that are going to be disconnected youth, not connected with permanent family. They're going to age out of the system with no, kind of resources, no social network to fall on, but they've increased in population. They're staying in care in record numbers. Most of the, before pre-COVID, we had a lot of kids hit their 18th birthday and say, check out. I don't want to have anything to do with this system that always tells me what to do and can't find me a family. They're staying in because the world is rather scary. So good for them. However, that's the only group that has increased. The school age population has taken a nosedive. Kids that have been out of school, we're talking about, the 6 to 16 have really decreased, with the 10 to 12 year old population being hit the most, declining by over 20%. Right? They're not in front of their mandated reporters on a daily basis, the teachers who see some of these things that are going on and doing the reporting. And so kids have been exiting care in those age groups, but haven't been entering care. The infants and the, preschoolers that have been in the daycare systems, have been in contact with their primary care physicians, have pretty much stayed about the same. So we're expecting that when everything really does open back up and there isn't this option for virtual school, or it's not on a 2 day a week rotating schedule, that it's going to be scary, the number of kids that come into care. And all my social service partners we're sitting here, in the same kind of huddle of, what are we going to do about this when the floodgates do open? And I think we're going to have to have a lot of families ready. I know we said that last year about this same time, but nobody thought this pandemic would go on for over a year like it has. So I'm hopeful that we can get some momentum and some support, because I'm fearful of what's coming to the system and want to make sure that the system is well prepared for it.
Mm-hmm. John, I'm wondering if you have anything to add from your perspective.
I see some positive. What I've seen positive, more time with children.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the force of everybody being kind of locked in the home, whether mm-hmm. it's virtual learning or whatever. The challenge, of course, is getting children to comply with the virtual learning and be consistent with that, and having flexible work schedules for families. That's been a huge struggle. But the positive side is I see that my families, and I'm just going to brag about my families because that's what I do, they have increased their influence, and I've seen a decrease in acting out behavior with a large population of my children that we would expect a lot of acting out behavior. And I've seen children attach at a deeper level because of that. It's kind of a mixed bag a little bit. You know, there's the side of more time together, and then the other challenges of not enough time away.
Right.
Right. At the same time, that makes sense.
It makes total sense, 100%, inside and outside of the foster care world, I think, too. Beautiful. All right, so this has been dynamic, and thank you so much for each of you sharing your time and energy and expertise with us. To sort of wrap us up, we're always kind of talking about the fact that this takes a village, right? There are social workers, there are foster parents, there are agencies, there are judges and court-appointed people who are helping out. There are volunteers, there are organizations, I could go on and on and on. And everyone here sort of has a special perspective. And we would love to know if you could tell us from your perspective with, you know, schools potentially reopening later in 2021, what do you see as either challenges, opportunities that may lie ahead, or speaking to people who, you know, care, right? Like, part of foster care is actually caring. So for the people who are listening who do care and have some sort of capacity to show up in a bigger way, whether that's from volunteering, donating, becoming parents, whatever that is, what do you have to say to them? And we'll give everyone like about a minute. Lakaisha, would you like to start us off?
Sure.
Great.
So some of the challenges that I see is the fact that many of not just the foster children, but a lot of children have been in the home, have been in the house. And so that social aspect of interacting with others again is something that we need to stay close to. We need to figure out ways to increase the social interactions that they have with precautions, of course, right? So we're staying safe. But how do we ensure that we're checking in with those folks that may not be as vocal about their feelings about going back to being in a social environment and making sure that they have the support? The other thing that worries me is the notion that we may put pressure on our teachers to go back to this place where they have to supply sanitizers and wipes and all that stuff for the children. And how do we as a village help the schools and the teachers with that support so that we're not asking the parents to do it or the teachers to do it?
Beautiful. Thank you for that. Tom, I would love to hear what you're thinking.
Well, my first thoughts are the fact that we only have newborns and young children, so we don't have to deal with the school systems and picking up and stuff like that. But I will say this about the system is that I think we need to have, and this is something that we've had to learn, we need to have faith in the system, faith in our caseworkers, our CASA workers, our guardian ad litem, judges. Everyone that surrounds this child who's making decisions on their behalf is to trust the system and have faith in them. And if you're as lucky as I know Wendy and I have been to connect with the families who are now in custody of children that we've had, how can we help you transition? Do you need, do you need clothes? Do you need food? I mean, what do you need? We've been fortunate to be connected with all of the children who have been through our home. So we feel sort of like grandparents, so to speak. But just being able to be a support in that way and to have faith in the system and that it works.
Thank you for that. LaCora?
So, I mean, again, I tend to be a glass half full, even working in this system for as long as I have. I will say that my hope right now is in the fact that the state has funded more money towards working with families prior to children entering foster care, and that as a state, we are working to really make an effort to engage families as well as engage relatives, more, you know, emphasis on those things and how to make that happen earlier. So, you know, it's the proactive instead of the reactive. My hope is in that and the efforts to, you know, really meet the family's needs prior to getting into foster care, because it is difficult once children enter care, it is much more difficult for children to exit the system. But at the same time, because of the pandemic, we've not been able to recruit the same way we used to recruit. It's not a knock mm-hmm. on the door, you know, so I'm hoping my heart in this moment is to the people who watch this and think, what can I do? I think you said it best, Erin, when you said there are different avenues. You don't have to be a foster parent. You can be a support parent, come be a mentor, you know, there are so many ways that you can jump in and be of assistance. And I am urging you to find your role, like find your lane and drive, like show up for these kids, not for me. Not, you know, there are kids I still keep in contact with that I don't even work in that area anymore, but I still keep in contact with them and they still reach, they still need me in some way. That's my commitment to them. So I would say, if I can do that, like, you know, doesn't, I'm not giving them anything, but just a hi and a, how's it going? Right. So, you know, think of where your lane is or what your lane could be. Find somebody who's connected to this program, the system, and then show up for these young people and these families.
I love that. Thank you so much.
Oh, and remember that the pandemic happened to all of us. Sorry, we don't give ourselves enough credit for that. Like, it's happening not to just the families we've identified that need the assistance. Like, we need assistance. We've had to deal with it. We've sat in the house with our own kids or our foster kids, our adopted kids. We've not been at work. You know, there's been changes that we've had to make as well. So this pandemic is clearly, like, it's a pandemic. It happened to everybody. And all of us give each other some grace coming out of this thing.
I think grace is always a good one to come back to.
Yes.
John, what do you see or hope for?
First of all, LaCour, good job. I love your passion for helping, and I feel it across the screen from you. What I'm expecting out of when we're coming out of this, I think people are looking for connections and a deeper connection. I think that's one of the blessings that's going to come out of this. And I think, this is just my opinion, I think that's going to help us find more families. And for those people that have to come into care, and I love LaCour's vision of, we've got to stop as many children coming into care in a positive way that we can. But for those who have to come into care, that deep connection that I think people are going to be starving for, I think they're starving for it already. If they could just hear, just like what we're doing right now, if they could just hear about the need, I think more people will show up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm excited about that.
Me too. Thank you for that. Audra?
Yeah, so I think that we need some training. Right. I think that there's a lot of stress that's happened and there's going to be a lot of dealing with what, like LaCour said, that we all went through this pandemic. We need some healing. These kids need some healing. And I'm excited about the opportunities to work and support parents that are doing this so that we can help them be successful with these kids. I think we know a lot more than we ever have before, certainly in the last several years, about brain science and what traumatic incidences do to our brain and how to work within our abilities to connect and move the needle. So I'm very optimistic about what foster care will be able to do for kids going forward relative to the current science, as well as what John said, our ability to, or initiative to help now. People in general have been more empathetic, I feel, more inclined to reach out across, you know, and help families. So I'm excited about that. But I'm also a little nervous about, you know, what it looks like when the doors do open.
Yeah, that's fair. I think it's really beautiful, the connections back to, unfortunately, you know, pandemics are pandemics, as we now know, but there is a connection back to our humanity and the fact that we need each other and all of this. And hopefully there's some, you know, space for self-reflection as everyone has gone through a traumatic experience collectively now. And to just think about, you know, what is life really about, right? And it is about like those connections and how can we make this a better place? And if you've been listening to this, clearly there's something on your heart that is calling you to play a part in this, to be part of, you know, the healing process and the healing that is available in this world. So I would just say to anyone who is listening, coming up, we have our annual event called Foster Care Aware that is brought to us by Tidewater Friends of Foster Care that will be happening on Facebook, YouTube. There's also a podcast, so consume it in any way you want. And I think what's even perhaps more important than the consuming is sharing. Part of this work and this world, the problem here is that not enough people know about what's happening. So if you could take a moment and either share this video or just talk to five of your friends about foster care in general. One third of the population in the US tends to think about foster care or adoption, but only 2% of people actually take action. So what is going to change that up? It's actually talking about it and starting the conversations. And instead of avoiding hard topics, actually taking the time to connect with each other, to talk about it, to brainstorm solutions, to see how can we help, what can we bring to the table with what we have. So thank you everyone, to all of our panelists. Thank you so much for being here and sharing your time and energy. And to everyone watching this, thank you so much. You are now being passed a baton, and you get to take that and pass it on as well. So again, thank you so much, and we will see you soon.